This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America, an update on the race for the White House in the aftermath of the first presidential debate between Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton and Republican nominee Donald Trump. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Political surveys before the debate showed the two candidates locked in a tight contest, with Secretary Clinton holding a narrow 2 percentage point advantage. But after the debate, several pollsters say Secretary Clinton could improve her margin after keeping Mr. Trump on the defensive throughout much of the debate, attacking him for refusing to release his U.S. income tax returns, for failing to pay some contractors he hired to build his golf courses and casinos, and for his lengthy history of slurs against women. Both candidates put their contrasting plans on the economy and America's role overseas in front of potential voters as they squared off in the first of three head-to-head debates. Monday's debate was the most watched ever, with 84 million viewers tuning in to see it live. That broke a record set by Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan in 1980. No debate since then had exceeded 70 million viewers. Mr. Trump repeated his assertion that his opponent lacks the stamina to be president and said her policies have led to a range of problems facing the country, including the threat posed by the so-called Islamic State group. Secretary Clinton portrayed Mr. Trump's economic plans as favoring the rich over the middle class and suggested he does not want to make his tax returns public because he is not as rich as he says, or he is hiding something that would be a conflict of interest if he were elected. The two candidates will debate twice more before the election on November 8. The next debate is scheduled for October 9. Well, with us to analyze the fallout from the first debate, which took place at Hofstra University in New York, are two veteran political analysts. John Fortier is a political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and that's a policy group based here in Washington. He's also a regular columnist for the Politico newspaper and a regular panelist at these VOA microphones. And David Hawkins, making his debut on Encounter. He's senior editor at Congressional Quarterly Roll Call. That's a venerable newspaper that reports on congressional news, campaigns, politics, and personalities. He's also the author of the Hawkins Here blog and column. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.
Well, John Fortier, our veteran regular columnist here, I'd like to turn first to you. What were your overall impressions, reactions to the debate?
Well, first, you mentioned this was the most watched debate ever, and I think that is because of Donald Trump, both because people are interested in him because he's a celebrity and not a traditional candidate, but also I think greater questions for him as to whether he can fill the role as president. Hillary Clinton is well known, but many people have opinions about her that are firmly fixed. And so coming into this debate, it was an opportunity for him. He certainly had closed up the polls. He was certainly behind before the debates. And I think you'd have to say, both common wisdom, some of the polling, he didn't do as well as he might have. It's not necessarily the end of the road for him, but it was an opportunity for him to show a little bit that he was more presidential, to show everybody for the first time that he could stand on the same stage as Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I would give him some higher points for some of the beginning of the debate, where he actually put out some of his different policies on trade and law and order, which at least I think he had a coherent position on and made the case to America. But at the end of the debate, he spent a lot of time defending himself against attacks in a long-winded way without really explaining himself. And I think he looked a lot better. I think he felt comfortable in the primary debates where he was on stage with many people and made short quips and attacks and found that the last hour of the debate, he was really on the defensive and really didn't have much to show for it. So I think overall, he may not be disappointed. He doesn't admit that he didn't do so well, but I think many of his supporters, other Republicans, were not so happy with the way he did.
David Hawkins, what's your overall impression, reaction to the debate? As John Fortier said, it seems that Clinton helped herself more than Donald Trump.
I think that's undeniably true. I would echo many of the things John just said. The longer the debate went on, the more uncomfortable Mr. Trump appeared. It is also the case, and we should sort of stop right away and say, the first presidential debate 4 years ago, when President Barack Obama was running for re-election against Mitt Romney, the Republican former governor of Massachusetts, Mr. Obama turned in a remarkably and alarmingly lackluster performance. And people woke up the next morning thinking, oh my gosh, maybe Mr. Romney is going to surprise everyone and win this. And by the time of the next debate, Mr. Obama had sort of got his debating act together and did very well, and of course, won re-election. So the poll that many of us are looking at is, it's actually by CNN, the cable news network. They do a scientific poll. They showed a 35-point gap between those who thought Mrs. Clinton won and those who thought Mr. Trump won. The only time that's ever been exceeded was this Romney-Obama debate that I mentioned from 4 years ago. And of course, the election turned out in Obama's favor. So one debate does not make the entire campaign, but it certainly has put a lift in Mrs. Clinton's step. Since the debate, she has spent a couple of days campaigning, sort of like a weight's been lifted off her shoulders. You can almost see it. And Mr. Trump is back at it with his typical dogged determination to not say he ever did anything wrong. He has essentially an impossible time admitting a flaw or a mistake or a misstatement, and he's just sort of plowed ahead.
He had a bad microphone, though.
He did have a bad microphone. We should just, to put that to rest for those of us sitting and talking to microphones, no doubt in anyone's mind that the two microphones were tested excessively. There were many, many sound checks. There's absolutely no reason to believe, as Mr. Trump has suggested, that a microphone would have been tampered with.
Well, speaking of microphone that he alleged was tampered with, John Fortier, what about the atmospherics? It seems that they played as much a role as perhaps the substance of the debate. He had some sniffles. He interrupted Clinton constantly. How do those things play into the debate and going forward?
To put it mildly, Donald Trump is an unconventional candidate, both in terms of his background, but also his personality. So I guess I don't think anybody should be surprised that he was argumentative and interrupting. And, you know, maybe that didn't work for some people and it worked for others, but I think that was the way he was going to be. I guess what really struck me was that he really did not find a way to turn away from speaking about or defending himself or really provide context to voters on many issues. Again, I think he started out the debate in an interesting way. I mean, especially interesting for a Republican, being somebody who is very skeptical of trade, but also pro-business and really wanting to sort of protect jobs using that whole narrative. I think he had a reasonable narrative about law and order, but he, you know, could have easily turned weaknesses of his, like his tax returns, to Hillary Clinton and say, well, you have issues with the Clinton Foundation, or you haven't released your health records. There's a simple answer and a quick turn that he could have made, but we heard endless explanations that were hard to understand. And so for someone who has been in many debates but has not been in a debate like that, I mean, just to know, he has not been in a one-on-one debate before. He's been in these large-scale debates with a Republican electorate watching, and he's now had to watch fill a lot of time, and it seemed like he was ready for some of it, but certainly not ready for the rest.
David Hawkins, what was missing for you or what struck you in the debate?
Well, it did strike me how many topics were left out. Remarkable to me that Mr. Trump has been talking all year long about the attacks in Benghazi, Libya, on the consulate when Mrs. Clinton was Secretary of State, a huge line of attack for him, never mentioned it once, did not, as you say, mention the Clinton Foundation, did not mention what he's threatened to mention, which is to somehow, in what I would think would have to be described as a very politically risky move, he's threatened to resurrect discussions of President Bill Clinton's marital infidelities and how that somehow connects to her fitness to be president. So lots of attack lines. And also what was missing, to state sort of the obvious point for somebody who thinks about policy like I do, is wasn't a lot of proactive discussion about how each of them would behave as president. In an election when these two candidates combined have the highest negative impression on the voters of any two major party candidates in American political history, they are both disliked by 3/5 of the public. That will probably mean that many people will stay home. Those people might be persuaded to come out and vote on November 8 if they have something to vote in favor of, not just vote against one or the other of them, but vote in favor. And neither Mrs. Clinton tried at the very top to talk a little bit about what she would do as president. Mr. Trump hardly at all. Amazingly, the other thing that was never mentioned was his immigration plan, his proposal to build this high wall for billions and billions of dollars and to get the Mexican government to pay for it. That was never mentioned. So I've got to assume that going forward, if they're going to go after undecided voters or people who might stay home, they will need to speak more proactively about what they would do as president and give the voters, those on-the-fence voters, something to vote in favor of.
Turning back to you, John Fortier, speaking of undecided voters, I think that is the question. Did Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton do anything to move that group in their favor after the debate?
I think Hillary Clinton doesn't have a whole lot of room to persuade people. She's been on the stage for many, many years. She does have high negatives, but she's also got a good base of support. I think her range of support is a pretty narrow band. Donald Trump, on the other hand, there's a little more up or downside for him. And I don't think he certainly helped himself.
He spoke to his base, more or less.
Well, you know, he spoke a bit to his base. I mean, I think, you know, the trick for Donald Trump is, I think he rightly makes the case that he's a different kind of Republican and that he has some issues that are much more appealing to white working class voters, certainly immigration, trade, and that he might bring in some extra voters that the typical Republicans don't get. But on the other hand, is he going to lose a bit of the party, the more upscale suburban women vote, parts of the party that are not so thrilled with him? If he reassured both of those groups, you know, that might be an expanded coalition. It's a hard task to do, but I think that was a challenge for him. He's got some opportunity to both, you know, continue to motivate some of the voters that are coming to him with his new policies and to reassure some of the traditional Republican voters who might be a little bit uncomfortable with him. And I don't think he really did that. I agree with David. These things are very hard to predict how they come out. Even in the polls, we'll see coming in the next week. Sometimes people will say, yeah, Hillary Clinton won the debate, but I still am for Donald Trump. We could see that. But I just think it was a disappointing night for him. He could have done better.
Turning back to you, David Hawkins, is anyone looking differently at Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton after this debate, particularly those so-called undecided voters who may swing the election one way or the other in what we call swing states, those states that could tip the election in favor of one or another?
Well, a lot of the initial polling, which focused in advance on these type of independent and swing voters, because the polling business in this country is pretty sophisticated and they've narrowed it down pretty well to, as we say, the white millennial or young adult suburban woman. Whoever wins those people will probably win Pennsylvania, Ohio, North Carolina, Virginia, maybe Florida. These are all the big ticket swing states with the big electoral votes. The early polling is she did better with them. She finished very strong on an issue that she believes will matter to them, which was this discussion of Mr. Trump's denigration of one of the Miss Universe winners. Donald Trump ran the Miss Universe pageant for many years. A woman who won the pageant, a Miss Venezuela from 1996, he derided with sort of Latina stereotypes, called her Miss Housekeeping, and then said that because she put on a lot of weight after she won the title, he started calling her Miss Piggy. These things don't sound good. And he didn't back away from them. He never backs away. And in the days since the debate, he's only intensified his criticism of this woman and said she put on a massive amount of weight. And he just sort of went there on all the things that a man running for president who's hoping to appeal to female voters just probably shouldn't go there.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are John Fortier, political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and David Hawkins, from whom you just heard. He's senior editor at Roll Call Newspaper and author of the Hawkins Here blog and column. We're discussing the fallout from the first presidential debate in the run-up to the U.S. presidential election on November 8th. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal fan from Herat, Afghanistan, Kazim Mohammadi. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We're interested in knowing what you learned or found most interesting about today's program. Well, back to our guests. First to you again, John Fortier. So now, where do we go from here? We're 6 weeks before the election, approximately. How important is this first debate, in your view, for setting the tone for future ones, for determining the race? Mr. Trump even still talks about potentially backing out of upcoming debates. How do you see this going forward?
I think David's point that we've sometimes seen a good or bad performance in the first debate and then a turnaround at another debate. I also point to, you know, Ronald Reagan's first debate in 1984 against Walter Mondale, where he was seen as too old, and in the second debate where he came back more strongly. So there certainly is the possibility for coming back. It will be a little less fresh. It will have probably a slightly smaller audience, but it's still an opportunity for him to move voters. Look, I think even leading into this debate, he's a little bit behind. Maybe closer in the polls than many people thought. I think he's actually got a better hold on the Republican electorate than he does on the Republican elite. So many Republicans are with him. But does he have enough to sort of expand the base enough to get through the election? We're going to focus a lot on swing states. That's absolutely true. I wrote a book on the Electoral College. I'm interested in that. But I guess I also want to caution people that you're not going to win the right mix of states to win the Electoral College unless you're winning the popular vote or you're very close in the popular vote. So if he's 2 or 3 points down, it doesn't really matter all this strategizing about which state. He's got to really get a broader base of support. And sure, that means in places like Ohio and Florida, which Republicans really have to win, but also in other interesting places, Iowa, maybe a place like Wisconsin or Nevada, perhaps Pennsylvania. There are some opportunities for him, but overall, he really does need to play on the national stage. And the second debate may be an opportunity for him to turn things around.
David Hawkins, again, same question to you. How important is this first debate in your view in terms of setting the tone for future ones, for determining the race? And of course, Secretary Clinton certainly has many vulnerabilities, as you pointed out earlier. She is very unpopular. And yet, compared to Donald Trump, people are looking at her differently.
Right.
What are her challenges as well?
Right. Just to sort of go back in time for just a moment. I mean, when this campaign began, the Republicans were quite literally falling all over themselves trying to run against this person who they viewed as the most vulnerable Democrat who could possibly be put up. So that's why we had 17 people running. And we've ended up with the candidate who, sort of on paper anyway, looks like the farthest away from the central casting version of a Republican who might beat Hillary Clinton, somebody whose own negatives are almost as high as hers. Yes, this set the tone. Yes, I think probably not 84 million, which is a remarkable number of people who actually spent a full 90 minutes watching this thing. I would just say that after every one of these big events in the campaign, where Mr. Trump has not done what the traditional political handlers, advisors, strategists would have told him to do, everybody says, well, next time he can try and do those traditional things, and he never does. His personality seems pretty baked in. His improvisational political personality seems pretty much like where he's going to go. It would be highly unusual, I think, if he suddenly became the sort of disciplined debater who actually rehearsed going forward. He didn't even, we should note, do a traditional rehearsals for this debate. He has decided, for whatever reason, that he's going to do it his way. It's going to be a very unusual way, and he seems kind of comfortable with that.
John Forty, let's talk about just a couple of issues that came up. For example, the tax returns. He has not released his tax returns. He claims they're being audited, but everybody knows that he could still release them. Correct me if I'm wrong, but pretty much every presidential candidate has released their tax returns as a question of transparency. And then he even said in the debate that if he didn't pay any taxes, as Secretary Clinton suggested might be the case, that that makes him smart. I mean, that might even go against his so-called base voters. These are working-class Americans who pay their taxes. I mean, how do we see this, his refusal to release something very basic?
Well, you're right. In recent history, candidates have released their tax returns. This is different. And he obviously has his reasons for not wanting to release them, because he could if he wanted to. I don't think that's a positive. I think if he wants to stick to that position, he's going to take a hit on there. I guess I would have counseled him to admit it, that, and say he's not going to release it and use all the reasons he wanted, and then to turn to Clinton and say, we need more transparency from you in these areas of health, or your Goldman Sachs speeches, or your Clinton Foundation dealings. I mean, there are things that you could throw against Clinton as well. So I don't think it's helpful to him, but I think, you know, as a candidate, if he wants to stick to that position, he's going to have to pivot quickly. On the question of whether seeming a billionaire who would avoid taxes is good for his base, which he's appealing to, of white working class voters, that seems very contradictory, except for the fact that his whole candidacy is contradictory in that way, right? Why is a billionaire getting that support? And part of it's that he is appealing to them on certain issues, and part of it is he has this persona that says, look, we want to be great in America again, and for me to be able to go out and make money, and for others to have that possibility, and for business to succeed. I mean, I don't know that it's an argument that everybody would buy, but certainly it is an argument that he was making maybe more effectively in this section of the debate on economics and trade. So there can be white working class voters who look to him because of his, you know, success and see that as a plus.
David Hawkins, do you see it as a plus, the fact that he's going to continue to refuse to release his tax returns and allude to the possibility that if he didn't pay taxes, that makes him smart? It seems to me a bit contradictory not very helpful.
It does, but there have been, as we're all aware, there have been a dozen, maybe two dozen, maybe three dozen times during this campaign where Donald Trump has said something that by normal conventional political standards would have been beyond self-defeating, would have been politically suicidal. And he has gotten away with it every time. He famously said at the start of this campaign, the most melodramatic thing of all, he said, you know, I could stand up in Times Square in the middle of New York City and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any votes. That's something he actually said. With each passing day, he seems to be getting closer and closer to testing that theory about as emphatically as he could. Insulting women, saying they're fat, refusing to pay his taxes. He really seems to be continuing to tempt political convention at every opportunity and still getting away with it. I mean, in other previous years, this would have been more than just a slight dip in the polls for him in the days after the debate. A candidate who did some of these things might have seen their polling support crash, and he hasn't.
Indeed. Well, we haven't talked much about national security, but they spoke about NATO alliances, which he, of course, has undermined or suggested that certain allies need to, in a sense, pay to play, which is certainly not what we consider part of traditional way of doing international relations, John Fortier. How will that hurt or help him? We've seen already many Republicans coming out, most recently former Republican Senator of Virginia, John Warner, coming out basically endorsing Hillary Clinton because, you know, he can't really support Donald Trump, particularly on national security.
Hillary Clinton obviously has experience, not only experience generally, but experience on the foreign policy stage, and has some Republicans with some respect for her. So she starts out in a reasonably good place. What I think Donald Trump tried to do, and the interesting part of his message, perhaps, and there's certainly dispute about this, is he's made the case that he was against the Iraq War. I know there's some dispute as to when he said that, but certainly earlier on was against the Iraq War. But he's also very much against the Obama administration's and Clinton policy of what has happened in the vacuum of the Middle East that led to the rise of ISIS. And I think his point is to be somewhat a pox on both your houses, that he is not going to be an interventionist, somebody who goes the world willy-nilly, but at the same time really focuses on American interests here. You know, I think that's a message he hasn't made in the most nuanced way. Again, foreign policy elites in Washington on the Republican side are most worried about Donald Trump, not only his experience, but his change in policy, his criticism of some of their policy. He doesn't have typical foreign policy advisors. You know, in some areas, economics, he has advisors that we would recognize. So I think it's an area where he is, you know, more off the reservation. But if he were to make his best case for what his policy is that, look, Hillary Clinton, like in many things, has been in the arena for a long time. A lot of things have gone badly. And in some ways, both the war in Iraq, which he maybe grudgingly supported for a while, and the policy on ISIS is wrong, and that he actually would have better instincts, if certainly not better experience.
Instincts, like stealing oil, which in and of itself is a very controversial policy and may not have been the answer to the rise of ISIS, right, many analysts point out. But again, David Hawking's on this question of national security, which affects most of our audience. I saw a tweet from a counterterrorism analyst, a very well-respected one, saying, you know, international relations is not like relations with the mob. Pay for protection.
Well, right. I mean, his apparent fondness for Vladimir Putin, his talk about withdrawing from NATO, the taking the oil thing, which I believe most people think is just a flat-out violation of international law. A government can't come in and seize private oil reserves of another country. Much of this, however, resonates with white working-class voters, with the base, people who don't think about international relations, people who are only thinking about their job, you know, putting their food on the table, don't care to even learn much about how foreign relations work. It sounds simple. It sounds straightforward. He's able to combine that with what I thought was one of his most effective lines on Monday night, which was to say, you've been at this for 30 years. Where are the results? I mean, that sort of outsider change agent talk can work against her. So he's been able to brew it together into a pretty remarkably effective line of campaigning that is kind of bewildering for people who actually think about national security and foreign policy during the week.
And as we close, John Fortier, what are you looking for in the coming days, weeks, next debate?
Well, look, I'm still watch the polls over the next week, just the general matchup polls to see if there really has been some fallout from this. I mean, debates, we don't think, have always the biggest effect on the ultimate outcome. There are a lot of other factors. And yet Donald Trump has much more upside and downside than Hillary Clinton. And it is possible that things really bottom out for Donald Trump. People have been predicting that all along and things get much worse. Or it is possible that he turns things around and really makes things closer. Again, I don't think Hillary Clinton really has that possibility. I think she's got a steady base. She's got a ceiling she can't reach beyond. But Donald Trump is the wild card.
The last word to you, David Hawkins.
Yes, Mrs. Clinton is clearly the front runner. She's ahead by a few points in the popular vote. She's comfortably ahead in the Electoral College map. She can kind of rest on her lead at this point and do what she has proved in high-pressure situations she can do. She is steady. She does not lose her cool in these debates. She is kind of steely. And she can be so steely as to drive Donald Trump crazy. I think we started seeing that towards the end of debate number one. Many of his supporters are ticked off that he didn't hit her harder on Monday night, that he didn't mention Benghazi, that he didn't mention Bill Clinton's extramarital affairs. He's going to be under pressure to be even more volatile and more provocative in round number two. It's a very high-risk strategy, and it's hard for me to see it working.
Well, stay tuned for continued analysis of the U.S. presidential election in the coming weeks. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, John Fortier, political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and David Hawkins, senior editor at Roll Call Newspaper. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rob McLean, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.